Coming up on This Week in Broadway, we talk with Julie Halston. We also discuss the Nymph production, He's Not Himself. We talk about Nymph Errant at the Prospect Theater Company, and we talk about the Bucks County Playhouse Grand Night for Singing. So please join us for that and much more on This Week in Broadway. Sing your foes, but you got it wrong. Enjoy your prayers because you haven't got long. Your queen is dead, your king is through. She's not coming back to you. Showbiz is kept us all alive since 17 October 1945. But the star is gone, the glamour's worn thin. That's a pretty bad state for a state to be in. Instead of government, we had a stage. Instead of ideas, a pyramid on his rage. Instead of help, we were given a crowd. She didn't say much, but she said it loud. And who am I who dares to keep his head held high while millions weep? Why the exception to the rule? Opportunist, traitor, fool, or just a man who grew and saw from 17 to 24, his country bled, crucified, she's not the
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 15th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer who you can find at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, Critchland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Peter, good morning.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see his writing at other outlets like Arts America, NPR. You could see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest, Julie Halston. Many of our listeners will know Julie from her many different roles on Broadway, including Anything Goes, 20th Century, Gypsy, Hairspray, The Women, The Man Who Came to Dinner. You may have also seen her in her off-Broadway performances of The Vagina Monologues, The Butter and Egg Man, and The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told. She also was recently in Love, Loss, and What I Wore, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And on television, we've seen her in the CBS sitcom The Class, and her most famous role ever is Bitsy Von Muffling. Bitsy Von Muffling, is that correct there?
Bitsy Von Muffling.
On Sex and the City.
Yes.
World renowned.
Yes.
And she's also a founding member of Charles Busch's legendary theater company, Theater in Limbo, and received a Drama Desk nomination for her performance in Mr. Busch's play, Red Scare on Sunset. So good morning, Julie. Thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning.
Good morning. It's all right. I actually usually do get up fairly early, so which is very unusual for performers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did start my life in the city working on Wall Street. So I think I've always had that corporate rhythm in my body somehow, so I do get up early. Of course, not that I'm moving a lot. I'm drinking coffee. You know, I'm not running the reservoir, you know.
Working on Wall Street. What were you doing on Wall Street?
I needed a job, you know, like people do.
Sure, yeah.
And I was a corporate librarian, and then I became like a research manager. And it was a full-time job. I, like some people, you know, when you first get into the city and you want to be in the arts, you go, oh, I'm just going to do this for a year.
Yeah.
Well, a year turned into almost 7 years.
Wow.
And for a long time, I actually did two full-time jobs. I worked from like 8:30 in the morning to like 6 at night. And then at night, I became a vampire lesbian of Sodom with Charles Bush's Theater Company. So it was a very interesting time and a very interesting way to become an actress. So that's what I did.
How did you handle your crossovers? Did you invite your people from your day job to your night performances, or did you keep them separate? Or
it was a little sticky, actually. It was a little crazy. My main boss was a really fantastic man, Doug Lane, that's his name, and he is actually still one of my dearest friends, and he's actually now my financial advisor, which is hilarious. And he was very supportive of the theater company. He thought Charles's work was fantastic. Other senior members of the company I worked for were none too pleased and rarely amused. But eventually, it was actually Doug who said, Julie, you need to make a choice. This is crazy. You either become a junior partner or you become an actress, you know, and just try to figure it out for yourself. And I took a class in financial calculus, and I couldn't understand one word of it in the first 10 minutes of the, and I literally walked out of the class. I told the teacher I will not be returning. I went to a payphone, because those were the days where payphones actually existed.
Yeah.
And I called Charles Bush and I said, get the wig ready. And that was it. I became a full-time actress. Get the wig ready. I remember it very, very clearly. I was at the New York Institute of Finance and I was in a payphone calling Charles Bush. It's kind of brilliant.
We're very lucky you didn't understand that course. We are.
Well, bless you. Bless you. Bless you.
I love the way an audience applauds when you enter. There's such enthusiasm. You know, that they're welcoming an old friend, and they're so happy to see you again that there's just that tumultuous applause that comes up. I remember it so vividly so many times. So, and it happens, you know, with that company. That's such a beloved company. And it's so interesting because who would have predicted that way back when? So you are an important building block of that company, to say the least.
Thank you. And, you know, it's very interesting. I was down on the Lower East Side last night, actually. Very interestingly, there was a party, actually, for Andrew Reynolds, who's going off to Hollywood and going to star in a new sitcom. And, of course, he was the star of the Book of Mormon. And Andrew and I did Hairspray together, and we became very, very close friends. And it was so interesting being back on the Lower East Side. I mean, it is so different, and literally I was on the streets that I used to walk as a member of Theater in Limbo, and, you know, this really was a time in the 80s of burned-out buildings and very creative expression. There were performance artists, like, in the street, and there was art in the streets, on buildings, on the sides of buildings, but it was really a blighted area. And there we were walking down East 6th Street, and I'm like, wow, you can't afford these now. There's restaurants all over. People are on the sidewalk drinking their rosé. And, you know, it was such an interesting change, obviously for the better in many ways. But it was just, I realized how much has happened over the last couple of decades, and... But it was a very, very creative time.
I just have to mention the Divine Sister, because how wonderful to have, you know, such a recent, wonderful, hilarious, long-running hit come out of that same. I don't remember if it was actually... billed as a theater in limbo. I mean, was it billed as theater in
limbo? It wasn't billed as a theater in limbo, but when we did talk about it, and I think one of the reasons it became, it was a long-running, 10-month, off-Broadway hit, was we really did try to capture a lot of what we did in the old days. We did it for fun. It was written quickly. Very much like the old days when Charles would just say, hey, come to my apartment, let's put on a show, let's do a reading. The sets were by the same set designer, B.T. Whitehill, that we always used. It was directed in, you know, the style by Carl Andrus, the style that we always did it. It was done very quickly. I think in some ways the quickness of those endeavors was really key to the success. We did not belabor anything. We had to get it done quickly. You know, Charles would write these things over weekends because we'd always have another, like, booking, you know, the next weekend, like Michael Limbo, because, you know, we'd have a great audience, and Michael would say, oh, well, what are you going to do next weekend? And Charles would be like, and he'd have to think about, like, what pop culture reference he was interested in. And I do remember standing on that stage and somebody shouted out, like, what's next week? And he went, Gidget Goes Psychotic. And people laughed, and he wrote it, like, the next weekend. And it became Psycho Beach Party because the Gidget people were not very happy. But, you know, it was that quickness that I think brought a real freshness, a sort of devil, not devil may care, but, you know, we were doing these things quickly. We had no time to belabor anything.
Did anybody ever say to you, gee, you're getting pigeonholed, you'll never work on Broadway if you continue with this little group?
Many people.
They were wrong.
They were wrong, but I will say it did take me a long time because it was one of those things that even my agents, I had to sort of convince them to really start sending me out for the mainstream stuff. And I do remember actually going into my agent's office and saying, how am I going to get to Broadway? And it was funny because they were like, well, we're not really sure because you're not a singer-dancer. But Jim Carnahan, who is the casting agent for the Roundabout Theater, was a huge fan of the Theater in Limbo works. And he really, really supported my efforts. And he slowly but surely started calling me in for Broadway. And, you know, I have to tell you something very interesting. This happened to me not too long ago. They did La Bette. Remember they did La Bette? Was that 2 years ago or so?
Yeah.
And Jim Carnahan called me in for La Bette. And I was like, geez, I've never really done a play in verse. Mm-hmm. This is what I love about the new world. I went to the internet and I literally typed in, how do I learn how to speak in verse? And I learned online in a night. And guess what? I got 3 callbacks. And I was really being considered. It ultimately went to Becky Baker. Becky Baker actually turned it down and they ended up going with a British actress. But is that a scream?
Sure.
And so, but again, I love the quickness of it. There was nothing belabored. It's very, very motivated. You have to do these things sort of on your own. But I sat there for a day and I taught myself how to do verse, and it worked out very well. So, yeah, you know, you constantly can keep yourself fresh and alive. You just have to, you know, you just have to keep saying, I'm going to learn a new skill set. I'm going to I mean, I had to tap dance and anything goes, the final tap. I don't tap dance. Well,
now you do.
Mm-hmm. Now you know. So it's constantly improving yourself.
So let's go back to Love, Loss, and What I Wore. How did you get involved in the show? And tell us about Nora.
Well, Daryl Roth, who is a very big supporter of Charles Bush, she produced The Divine Sister. Mm. She is also a supporter of my work. She, when Love Loss came about, she said, Julie, we have to get you in. This is just up your alley. Because you really do have to communicate very intimately with an audience. You have to... Love Loss is constructed so that you do actually do scenes and little vignettes with your fellow actors, but you also do monologues right out to the audience. And given that I actually do my own solo work, it was a natural fit. The first time I went in, I was working with LaTanya Richardson, Doris Roberts, Anna Klumsky, and... Oh, I forgot who the other person was. Emily Burgle? Emily Burgle. All really great performers, fantastic performers. And Brooke Shields. And anyway, we all sat around, and it was Nora and Delia were there. Nora and Delia, it was almost like it was their child. They were so committed to this piece. They put in all the different companies. And Karen Carpenter, the director, we all sat around. We talked a lot about our own feelings about clothing. They were very nurturing to us. Nora is a very, very precise. And, I mean, if you read any of her obituaries. She was a pretty controlling person because her command of language was very, very exact. But she was incredibly supportive, and we just would read through the material. She'd give us gentle suggestions. She and Delia were just incredibly smart about your choices. Like if they didn't necessarily love one of the choices that you came up with, they would gently steer you in the right direction. Nora and Delia both came to so many shows. I don't know how many performances they saw, but I venture to say, you know, hundreds and hundreds. They were very, very supportive of women, of women's issues, of women's problems, of women's humor, of women's mm-hmm. concerns. And I learned a lot about structure through that piece. It is beautifully constructed, and that is the Efron sisters at work.
Well, we mentioned it, of course, in our discussion of the passing a few weeks ago, and I said that I'll never forget how much I loved the show, especially considering the fact that I don't think that I would have been considered the target audience.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, exactly.
It really was very very universal, and not maybe what one might have thought when one read the description of it, you know.
Oh,
but on the
other
hand, it's, you know, it's Nora Ephron and her sister, and, you know, the New York Magazine just printed a reprint in its entirety of the first article that she ever wrote for them, and it's so, you know, it holds up so well. This is 1969 or something like
fantastic.
That.
Fantastic. Yeah, yeah, I mean, these are sharp, sharp, insightful people, and,
yes,
you know, there are plenty of sharp, insightful people, but the fact that this was a sharp, insightful woman writing at a time when, you know, let's face it, there are still glass ceilings to be broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a big, big, this is a big loss, you know, and it's important, I think, for women to really understand what a loss this is, and that we need to keep her work going, but also really be inspired to do our own. She's very big on that, you know. The Efron sisters are like, do it, do it, do it. Just go ahead and do it. Don't talk about it. How about doing it? And that's important, you know. So, very inspiring. I did it a couple of times, Love Loss, and I'm so glad I did. It's one of my favorite theatrical experiences. Plus, it was 10 blocks from my home. So I loved actually every night walking down to the West Side Theater and, you know, coming out and always greeting women and our fans and whatnot. And then I could just sort of saunter home, and it was, like, delightful. So, anyway.
All right. So you have a show coming up at Birdland next Monday, the 23rd of July at 7 p.m. You're going to be doing your show Classical Julie. Let's talk a little bit about that. Tell us about that show and how it fits into your experience.
Well, I love, again, I love, you know, performing in spaces that are near my home. It must sound like I'm a recluse, but once again, you know, I walk to Birdland. Jim Caruso and I are very, very old friends, and I just adore him. And he said to me, he called me up, and he said, well, you need to do another show. You haven't been here in like 9 or 10 months. You need to do another show. And I'm wildly unambitious in many ways. I love sitting around and just drinking my coffee and, you know, just sort of reading the paper or going online. You know, people go, oh, you should do that. You should do that. I go, yeah, yeah. But whenever I get a date, I go, okay, book me sometime in the summer. And meanwhile, it's like 6 months, you know, when he asks me. So I don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But once I have a deadline, then I actually go into action. And I was so heartened to hear that Sarah Salzberg, who wrote Spelling Bee, mm-hmm. is the exact same way I am. She sits around, and then when she has a deadline, she gets to work. I was so heartened by that. I was out in Sag Harbor with Charles Bush. We were doing the lady in question. An actress came in. She will remain nameless. I love her, but she just will remain nameless. She came in. I said, "Where have you been?" She said, "I was on the phone with my agent fighting." I said, "Oh, what were you fighting about?" She said, "Well, he wants me to go in for one of the leads in a new Tom Stoppard play. And it's going to go to Broadway. But I told him I'm not interested because I want to go sailing for a couple of months with my boyfriend." Mm. Well, you can imagine. Mm. My eyes were spinning in the back of my head. Okay. There I am in a wig, cap, a girdle, and pantyhose. I know, don't conjure it. It's sad. But and then she left. Meanwhile, by the way, she did go on that sailboat. She didn't get the part because she never went in. And the boyfriend dumped her after the sail. Hello.
Ah.
I went into a rant about, I can't get seen for the Tom Stoppard play. And so... And Charles was laughing so hard, he was like, "Oh my God," you know, because I turned into a Sicilian fishwife from Comac, you know, ranting and raving, you know, why am I not seen for Hedda Gabler? Blah blah blah. You know, I could do Ibsen, and you know, I can't get into the Tom Stoppard play, and I know there's a middle-aged woman in that. Well, Charles was just on the floor. He was like, he actually was laughing so hard he didn't know if he was going to make his next. And all he said to me is, "You better remember this story." Well, cut to a couple of years later, meaning now, and something I read in the paper, again, something about the Public or whatever, Shakespeare in the Park or something. Someone was reimagining Shakespeare. And I thought, you know, it would be interesting and funny if I actually started doing classical pieces in the Julie Halston manner. And also to discuss the idea that I feel I have the depth and the gravitas to do classical work. So that's when I started writing this piece called Classical Julie. And it will involve me doing some, you know, classical pieces, but it will also have some of my standards, you know, the Julie Halston reading of a wedding announcement, you know, possibly the reading of Joan Crawford, which I know I'm known for. Mm-hmm. But I also have like new wedding. I have a new wedding announcement, which was so amazing. I don't know if any of you made it to Bradshaw Smith Memorial.
Yeah.
Yes. And I literally have been looking for a really inspiring and moving wedding announcement for a long time. I hadn't found one, and a week and a half before his memorial service, I found this, and I swear it was like Bradshaw guiding me to. So it's fun for me to have really new material, and I have a really fantastic story about a recent visit I had with an old childhood friend of my family. So it's a lot of new stuff. But it's all about why is Julie Halston not being seen to do Shakespeare. And I do Shakespeare, my reimagining of Shakespeare is that I really feel, if you're going to reimagine, really go deep. My reimagining of Lady Macbeth, for example, is to have Lady Macbeth be done as Little Edie. So I do Lady Macbeth as Little Edie. And I have to say... I think it's marvelous. I think it's really fantastic. So these are the new things. I see, I love that you're laughing already. I think these are the kind of things that I'm going to, well, they not saying God. These are the things that I'm bringing to the table on July 23rd at Birdland.
So, Julie, you bring up Little Edie, and I want to talk about a different Edie, that Edie Falco woman.
Yes.
And Linda Lavin, and what are we going to do about them?
Yeah, who dat that Linda Lavin? Well, you know what's interesting, though? First of all, you know, and I'm a shameless name dropper. I know both those women. And in fact, Linda actually really is a friend. I mean, she is an incredible inspiration. But what's fantastic is that ultimately, I really do feel that I will be going into the roles, in a sense, that those women can bring. You know, Linda and I have a lot of similar...
I can see that.
You know, cadences and whatnot. And in fact, it was Nicky Martin who said to me at Lincoln Center, at a Lincoln Center party, you could do that. And now it's just a matter of having people see that. And that's something I'm actually working toward in the next year or two is, as much as I loved, I mean, I loved being in Anything Goes. I mean, there is nothing in the world like being in a beautiful, big, hit Broadway musical.
Sure.
There is nothing in the world that will really, on a certain level, top that. Mm-hmm. But I'd actually like to be in plays. Judith Light and I have talked about this. I look at a play like Other Desert Cities. I could play that role. You know, I could play some of these roles now. These, you know, middle-aged women of a certain humor, of a certain pathos. I really would like to move into those areas. So, you know, that's yeah, what are we going to do about those women? Nothing but enjoy them. But
right.
Ultimately, yeah, I would like to move into that realm. For a long time, we were very defined by theater in limbo, as did Charles. I mean, Charles, it took him a long time to write something like The Tale of the Allergist, where it would actually go to Broadway. We're very proud, though, of that theater company. It was a phenomenal 7 years. It got a lot of us kind of in a different place.
Sure.
It was also a theater company that helped people get through a terrible time in our city,
yes,
which is the AIDS crisis. It was just awful. We were, you know, not only were people really dying, many, many, many people, but many people in our profession. So it was a terrible time for us. We lost 3 members ourselves,
right,
and who passed away. And but, you know, everyone's journey is so different, and it sounds so, you know, new age woo-woo, but the journey is the thing, and you just have to keep moving forward. The minute you just say, well, you know, I guess I stop here now,
mm-hmm,
that's when you really stop creatively, or... You know, that's just never a good idea.
Sure.
You need to keep moving forward like a shark. You need to keep moving. And, you know, until the world tells you when to stop, you don't stop. You just keep going and you say, okay. And you know, let's face it, this is a career that is difficult. It's full of disappointments and, you know, hurts sometimes. And so you have to constantly, you know... navigate it. And let's, you know, actors can be very wifty, unreliable, crazy people that belong in state hospitals. But a lot of them are fantastic, intelligent, fabulous human beings with a great deal of fortitude. Nobody really thinks of actors that way, but I know them as people who face challenges in a fantastic, positive way. So,
yeah. Let me tell everybody how they can keep tabs on what Julie is doing. You're at twitter.com/Julie Halston, or you're on Facebook at facebook.com/official Julie Halston, or juliehalstononline.com.
Right.
So there's, and remind everybody that Birdland is coming up next Monday, the 23rd at 7 p.m., Classical Julie,
yeah,
and you can get
and
tickets.
And we're very sold, but we do have some tickets. We do have tickets left.
212-581-3080, and perhaps if we can get 300 or 400 people to call, to extend the show for you.
Fantastic. So, that would be nice. And actually, at some point, I'm hoping to, and I'm usually not like this, but at some point I would like to do a run again of a piece. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. Maybe I will actually use this one.
Julie, you've mentioned a few times that you like to stay in your neighborhood. You know, in the theater district.
Yes.
And it's kind of bewildering to some folks who listen to our broadcast that you say you've gone down to the East Village. And, you know, the East Village is basically 5 miles from you, but people don't understand how New Yorkers really stay in their neighborhood.
It's very true. I mean, and I actually do move around quite a bit. But yes, it is funny that way.
I was just going to say that, you know, didn't you cause a little bit of a stir in Istanbul, Turkey?
I did. I was recognized as...
You got on the wrong train that day.
I know, I got on the wrong train. I do travel. I was actually, that was an amazing trip. By the way, financed by a residual check from Sex and the City. Thank you, Sarah Jessica. we went to Rome, Sicily, and Istanbul. Hello, that's a nice check.
Yeah.
That was a great check, and I was walking down this main street in Istanbul, and I was recognized as Bitsy Van Muffling, which, hello, come on now, really? That was fantastic. And there's this wild gay population in Istanbul. Who knew? Well, guess what? Now I know. And if I'm ever there again, I know which clubs to go to for the free drinks and eats. Because Bitsy walks in and suddenly, you know, people are flocking. It was kind of great. Plus, I was wearing a little jacket that actually had the Sex and the City logo on the inside because, you know, it was one of those in transition weather jackets. Mm-hmm. And people were very excited about that. So, yeah, it's amazing. You know, America does have one amazing, well, we have many great exports, but our entertainment is a big thing all over the world. So
absolutely,
right. Yeah.
All right, Julie. Well, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us. We really appreciate
it. Fantastic. I'm going back to my coffee and reading. I'm reading about Alan Cumming doing Macbeth.
His one man show. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. But he's not doing Little Eating.
Great.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Julie.
All right. Well, it's fun to have Julie on. She's a very funny woman. She's very good. So this week has been, started at least for me with a lot of Nymph shows. Peter got to see He's Not Himself at Nymph, which is the New York Music Theater Festival. Peter, tell us about He's Not Himself.
It's a musical by a gentleman named Mark Silverberg. He wrote the book, he wrote the music, he wrote the lyrics. And there aren't too many shows that have been successful where somebody has written all three. I always have the suspicion when someone writes all three that it means he's approached collaborators who say, no, it's not a good idea, or no, I don't want to work with you. And that's why that happens. So because really you can count on one hand the great musicals that have been written by one person. Now Mark also decided to give himself a part in the show. So I guess that makes it like Legs Diamond, you know, because Peter Allen did so much and was in the show too. But this show isn't nearly as good as Legs Diamond, which you may recall was one of the worst shows of the 80s. But anyway, I was turned off from the beginning because it's about a policeman who sleeps with a teddy bear. Now, you know, I mean, Matthew Broderick sleeps with a teddy bear too, a nice work if you can get it. I hope this isn't an epidemic, but anyway, he's a policeman. A minor policeman, as they say, he deals with parking meters. He's often referred to as a meter maid. However, he's always wanted to be a gangster, and I'm not sure we can get behind him terribly much in that ambition. But as it turns out, every time he's hit on the head, he turns into a gangster. It's that type of thing. So he gets hit in the head a lot. Ironically enough, there's a scene once where he's with a woman in her bedroom, and he does fall on the floor, and he does hit his head. But nobody's noticed that who's worked with the production and has made anything of that. So that time it doesn't happen. So it's not even consistent, you know, that's I think the gentleman who's playing the role should be arrested for impersonating an officer, but also arrested for impersonating a gangster, because I think he's quite terrible in the role. It's done, it's set in the 40s, it's done the film noir style, and one the person who's narrating the story has a problem using expressions that we've all heard. So in other words, he doesn't say birds of a feather, but birds of a sweater, and he doesn't know he's making these mistakes, and that's supposed to be funny. I will say I like Carol Voigt a good deal as a Nightclub Chanteuse, and if anybody wants to know what Marion Mercer was like in Promises, Promises in her Tony-winning role, who played it very differently from Katie Finneran in the recent revival, you should go to see He's Not Himself. I'm not saying that that's really enough to get you there, because even though it's set in the 40s, there are some anachronisms. At one point, Carol Voigt doesn't want to hear something, so she sticks her fingers in her ear and says, la, 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 la. And I really don't think that was happening then. Mr. Silverberg reminds me very much of Harvey Fierstein, much younger, a better voice, but nevertheless, they may be birds of a sweater. I think that's could very well be the case. So, it's a show where love is supposed to conquer all, too. And anyway, I really thought it was not good at all. And I suspect we've seen the last of He's Not Himself.
To add to our complications here, there's a show called Nymph Errant, which is not part of the New York Music Theater Festival, which is NYMF. Sometimes called Nymph, but this is actually Nymph, NYMPH, Errant. And Michael and Peter got to see this, so somebody please clear up the confusion for me.
Well, that's the long and short of it. I'm interested to hear Peter's thoughts, because the friend who I went with and I both agreed that it was a near miss, in the sense that they got a lot of it right, but not all of it. And especially a show like this, which is a light, fluffy, you know, musical comedy of another era and another style, you really need, they need to be almost perfect, the productions, in order to keep them afloat. Whereas, do you know what I'm saying? Whereas a more serious musical like, Fiddler on the Roof, it has its own inherent quality to it, and its own depth and drama to it. So I think that you're less likely to see a bad production of Fiddler on the Roof than one of something like Nymph Errant, you know, because it's so just so light and so silly, you know. To make a long story short, this is a revised version of a Cole Porter show that was never done. It was initially done in London and did not come to New York at that time. It was not done on Broadway. There have been one or two sort of efforts to perform it here in one form or another since then, but nothing really major. And there is a recording of it that was done some years ago that people really treasure, because it's quite a rare commodity. And it has some wonderful songs in it, including the most famous one, which I think we commented on last week, is called The Physician, which is about a woman giving a list of, how her physician examined her and said, you know, that her epiglottis was this and her sternum was that and everything was great, but he never said he loved her as a whole. "Quote unquote," as a whole, mm-hmm. and even the way that line is used is, you know, it's mm-hmm. for great hilarity when you hear this song done. It's a brilliant, brilliant song. There's another song called "Experiment," which is not as famous, but is really, really a terrific song about kind of being a free spirit and leaving yourself open to experiences. And basically, in a nutshell, the show is about this young girl who's straight out of finishing school, and she goes traveling the world, you know, on a series of adventures, meeting all of these different types of men that she becomes involved with. And it's funny that this show reminded me of both Candide mm-hmm. and also Little Me, which of course,
good. Yes,
right. Which came later, and it's interesting too because this show contains a pun that is also central to Little Me in that the Belle Poitrine pun, which means Belle Poitrine literally means beautiful chest, and in Little Me it's actually the name of the central character, and here it's I forget how it came up. Was it the name of the?
It comes up a lot. It's certainly part of a nightclub sequence in a song, so sure.
Yeah, it's the name of a song and blah, blah, blah. So that was interesting that it reminded me of those two. But anyway, to come right down to it, the book was rewritten for this production by Rob Urbinati. And I thought, not knowing the original, I thought that from what I could tell, he did a really excellent job of updating the book and rewriting it. I thought it was quite funny, even though I noticed as it was happening that I kind of felt that some laughs were missed because of the timing and the direction or whatever. I would hear a line and it would not get a laugh, and I would think to myself, you know, that's a funny line and would have been if they had just said it this way or blah, blah, you know, or staged it differently. So that's the good news. And I thought that a lot of the performances were nice. I thought the woman who played, unfortunately, the woman who played the character who sang the physician was completely miscast for that type of song. She didn't understand the humor of it. And that was a huge disappointment because, as I say, it's such a great song. But I think in this production, it really did not make the effect it's supposed to. There's a nice little four or five piece band that sounds really good, and the general style was right, I think, and a lot of the other performances were good. But one of the major problems, and I was surprised, and Peter said, "I wonder if they're going to do this," and I said, "Oh, I doubt it." Mm-hmm. They added, all right. First of all, they added, I think, three or four songs that were in the show originally and were cut at some point, you know, along the way. But then on top of that, they added another three, I believe, that are from other Porter shows, most famously Red Hot and Blue, which is the title song of another Cole Porter show. And you know, there were so many songs in it to begin with, plus the ones that they added back, plus the ones that they added from other shows. This show had so many freaking songs in it. It was just song after song after song, and it was the first act was almost like an hour and 20 minutes long. And I said, please, you know, I'm very surprised they did that. And I'm surprised at them to even think that they would need to add songs from other shows. That's I don't know how they could have made such an unfortunate decision. And that really hampered the show a lot, plus the other flaws that I mentioned. So, again, we thought it was a near miss. What did you think, Pete?
I would have to agree with that, but I think my affection was a little stronger than yours. I thought they got the style quite right, and I enjoyed that part of it. I think I understand Mr. Urbinati's instincts here, and I don't think that he was wrong, because originally this was a story about a woman, Evangeline, who is determined, once she gets out of finishing school, to have one sexual adventure after another. Now, that doesn't quite happen in this version. It does happen in the second act, but for the first act, she seems to be intent on keeping her virtue. And while I don't know the original, because I wasn't around in London in 1933, it strikes me that if indeed this were a two-act musical where a woman is determined to find sex, and either does or doesn't, that would get a little boring. So I think he was wise to do that. So my hat's off to him for finding something a little different to improve it. That said, I'm always in favor of seeing shows as they were originally done rather than a revised version with a new book. And I'll tell you in this case what really was interesting to me. Early in the show, there was a reference to a guy whose hands are quite large. And of course, we know what they're talking about there. They're not just talking about hands. They are making an assumption there. Now, the question becomes, is that Rob Urbanati's new line, you know, or right. is that indeed a line from the original show? If that's a line from the original show, wow, that must have packed a wallop in 1933. Mm-hmm. My guess is it's not, you know, but nevertheless, the fact remains that we have to wonder. And I'm sorry that we have to wonder, but right. I mean, we have a completely different take on that line, if indeed it was in from the beginning. I have to admit, even though I have heard the title Nymph Errant now and forever, only when I was sitting there did it occur to me that this was a pun on knight errant. I mean, I feel humiliated to admit that, but I have to. It never occurred to me. Knight errant means a roving knight, and nymph errant means a roving nymph, and she does rove. Yes, I didn't think of me, Michael, and that you were wise to do so, but I certainly did think of Candide, because it does have this picaresque quality.
Yeah.
So so that was really quite fine. Yes, the Red Hot and Blue thing was amazingly regrettable because, after all, it's just done as a nightclub number, so it's not as if you need it. I understand entirely why they felt they had to give that character a number so to establish her. I should mention that that Evangeline runs into classmates here, there, and everywhere. And I mean, this show does take her here, there, and everywhere. I mean, she goes to Paris, she goes to Austria, she goes to Venice, Greece, Turkey, back to Paris, and back to Oxford, where she started from. But it's so interesting, though, everywhere she goes, she meets a classmate. So in a strange way, she's having a class reunion, but one person at a time. So she goes to a nudist camp. And that going to a nudist camp, you know, it's such a light show. In a strange way, some people may disagree with this violently. You don't want to see nudity in a little fluffy show like this because it would be too severe.
Right.
So they have them dressed in frocks, and everybody's anatomically correct. I also thought it was how democratic it was that every man was exactly of the same girth and size. I guess this really does prove when you've seen one, you've seen them all. But anyway, it's just one adventure after the other. As I say, not wanting sex in the first act, starting to want it in the second act. And I had a decent time. I did think it was too long, certainly. I won't disagree with that for a tenth of a second. But nevertheless, what I did regret more than anything else was at one point a character says, "Oh no, not a dance number." And that strikes me as a post-Urinetown type of remark, where we're commenting on musicals and criticizing musicals within the framework of a musical. My guess is that wasn't in at 1933, but I can never be sure. I can't be sure.
Right.
So anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing a real Nymph Errant sometime. Wouldn't you know, I was in London, missed it by an hour a few years ago when Ian Marshall Fisher's group did it. So I guess this will have to do for now. But frankly, I was entertained because I really thought they had the style down right. So my compliments to the chef and Prospect Theatre Company. I mean, really, you don't expect them to do something like this. They're usually doing new musicals, usually Kara Reichel and her husband Peter Mills whip up some really good stuff. But Will Pomerantz, who directed and choreographed, I thought really had the style down right, so I had a decent enough time.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, as I said,
style. Sure.
I think they, yeah. So I just, it makes it all the more regrettable that some of those other decisions were made. But it is interesting what you say. I mean, I wonder if either one of us tried, if we could even, you know, attempt to unearth the original book in book form to read it and sort of compare. But one of the things that, I mean, it must have been tricky because the way it's done here, as I recall, in Act One, especially, the central character keeps saying
she keeps using the phrase, you know, are you going to take advantage of me?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, we had the rape discussion of several times on the podcast. That's something that has become much, much more dicey over the decades. But it, especially here, because it gets into that very, very tricky territory where, well, if she really wants it, you know, and if that she's going out looking for it, and yet she's using that phrase, what exactly does she mean? You know, is it just part of the, you know, a sexual fantasy to be taken advantage of, like, you know, by a chic, you know, kind of exotic character, you know, like in silent movies, in, you know, Rudolph Valentino. I mean, I guess that's what it means, but it can be a little dicey. And I thought he handled that pretty well under the circumstances, because that can really leave a bad taste in people's mouth if it's not done right.
Well, the fact is, sure, having to ask, are you going to take advantage of me, does indicate that these guys aren't ready to rape. So it wasn't as severe to me. But I'm reminded of something I heard a long time ago, which was there's always a fascinating moment in any woman's life when she decides she's not going to be a virgin anymore. And this actually, in essence, happened at the end of the first act here. So I thought that was a good cliffhanger, so to speak. I think there's a lot of thought that went into this production, and I'm pleased that there was an intelligent take on it. But there's never a time when I prefer a revisal to an original production. So that's me. And it may very well be that if they had done the original book, I would. It might have lasted even longer, Michael. You know, sometimes they did, and I might have been saying, "Oh my God, why didn't they cut this? And how could today they should have?" You know. So we all do our own revisals in our heads, and we all do our own improvements of what we think are improvements in our head. So,
One reason I brought up that specific thing is that I was wondering, because if you read the program notes, which I'm sure you did, they claim that Porter himself supposedly said that he felt that the book would have to be completely rewritten if the show were to be revived in later years. I'm assuming that's accurate and they're not making that up. And I was wondering why he felt that way exactly. Was it because of, were there all kinds of topical references in the book that didn't work anymore? Or did it have something to do with the way in which she goes around seeking sexual fulfillment, you know? So that's, as you say, is something we can't know until such time as we see the original with the original book, or we get a copy of it.
Ironically enough, I do own the original novel. It was a big bestseller at its time. It's not even that hard to find in used bookstores, because there were, I have no idea if there were millions of copies sold, but really it was a big hit book, by the same title, by the way. But I've never read it. Being more dutiful, I would have started it immediately when I got home, but I'm in the middle of Loverly, the book about the creation of My Fair Lady, and it's terrific. So as a result, Nymph Erin's going to have to wait.
All righty. So let's move forward. I wanted to just mention quickly that I went, after last week's recording, down to New Hope, Pennsylvania, to the Bucks County Playhouse to see Grand Night for Singing. Before I even got into my car and left, I knew that I wasn't a fan of the show, A Grand Night for Singing. I'm not much for reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. I was really going down to see the theater and see what they did with it. It's really amazing. I met with Jed Bernstein after the performance and talked a little about what they did with the theater. And it's, you know, we had talked a few months ago when the Bucks County Playhouse, maybe almost a year ago, and I had said that I didn't think that Jed was going to have a hands-on day-to-day role in this, in the Bucks County Playhouse, and I was totally wrong. He's there. He's got an office there. He still has his office in New York, and he's producing a play coming to New York called Grace. So he is busy, and he's also got a Driving Miss Daisy that's going to Australia. So he is doing other stuff. Bucks County Playhouse is not his full-time gig, but he certainly has thrown a lot of time, effort, and money into the Bucks County Playhouse, and it really shows. It's a really great space, and hopefully it's going to be a nice area to develop a new theater community, a renewed theater community, because Bucks County Playhouse has been a long-standing venue that has fallen into disrepair over the years. But
yes, indeed.
But it's really, it was a very, you know, I'm not a fan of Grand Night for Singing, but it's a very high-quality production. Ron Bomer and a handful of other folks were in it. It was very well done. It's great material. I'm just not a fan of reviews.
Yeah, I agree.
But they have Barefoot in the Park coming up soon. And also, I spoke to Jed, and Jed's a morning person, so he was up for talking with us maybe in August or so. And so
I'm going to go down for Barefoot. And by the way, Barefoot started there. I think it might have even had its old title of Nobody Loves Me when it was there. But that was the original title. And also Victor Velasco, the eccentric late middle-aged man in the play, had a different name then. I remember very vividly reading in Variety that the character name had been changed. But I don't know what the original name was. It would be the first question I would ask Neil Simon if I ever ran into him. What was the original name of Victor Velasco? But anyway, I am going down for Biffin in the Park. And yes, I mean, there's no question that that theater had fallen into terrible disrepair in hard times. And people who worked there were very discouraged about the quality of life that one had to deal with while dealing with the theater. So good for Jed, and I look forward to giving my report when I go down in a few weeks.
My recommendation to anybody who goes down there is to get down there early. It's a beautiful town, New Hope, to walk around and get a bite to eat, but more importantly is that it's really hard to park. Parking can be between $10 and $20 if the lots are not empty. Are not full, excuse me.
Wait, the theater has parking itself, but it costs 10 to 20 or not?
Yeah, the theater shares a parking lot with a shopping center or a type of thing, but they charge $10 a car to get into the parking lot in front of the theater if there are spots. But there are certainly more seats in the theater than there are spots in the town. If it is a nice day, the town is very, very busy. And it's hard to find parking, so get down there and do something. But they actually redid the parking lot, which was one of the big things. If you've ever been down to Bucks County Playhouse before, the parking lot was a disaster, but they redid the parking lot as well. And it's such a great little town, New Hope, and there certainly you can see the millions and millions of dollars that have gone into rejuvenating this theater. It's beautiful, and they have another round of construction that they're going to do next year, but we'll talk with Jed about that when he comes on.
Good. That's really good news, because I was just listening to NPR, and they were talking about the very sad state of the Intiman Theater in Seattle.
Well, Intiman has gone through so many executive director changes, and I think that they just got a new executive director, if I remember correctly. But you know, all theaters worldwide are suffering, especially nonprofit theaters that depend upon private donations and government support. Many of the theaters that are over in the United Kingdom depend upon public support, which actually is very interesting. There's a lottery in the UK, and I think we've mentioned this before in the podcast, is that proceeds from the national lottery in the UK go into the arts. It's not, you know, it's a really interesting formula where, you know, if you're going to produce a play, you go and ask the government for money, and this money comes from proceeds from the lottery. And there's one of the sources that it can come from, but that's a major source of it. But they're going through this in the UK as well. They have a terrible financial austerity in the UK, and the arts programs are getting cut left and right, and it's really sending shockwaves all the way through their very local productions, all the way through the West End. So Intiman, you know, Broadway, and all various companies in and around the world are all getting hit by the changing economy. All right, so next on the list, we are going to go back to NYMPH, the New York Music Theater Festival, but we're going to talk about Himself and Nora, which is different than He's Not Himself, which is very confusing again. So but Peter saw this. So let's talk about himself and Nora. Give us a intro there.
Well, in a way, there are similarities, not just with the word himself, because we also have another show here with book, music, and lyrics by one person. Jonathan Brielle is the person who did this one. This one is more successful, but ultimately unsatisfying, too, because this is a musical about James Joyce and his relationship with a woman named Nora. She was the woman behind the man in many respects, but she was always behind the man in the sense, of course, that he became much more important. They didn't get married for a very, 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 very long time, and that becomes an issue in the show. Unfortunately, it becomes too much of an issue. Here's a man who wrote Ulysses, which was really a hot book at its time. It was banned in the United States. In fact, people actually used to take pleasure cruises out into the ocean, and when they were so many miles outside, when it wasn't the United States anymore, so to speak, that's when the books were brought out and people read Ulysses. I mean, that actually happened. In the musical Tavarich, there's even a mention of, have you read Ulysses? Well, only the final, I think, 80 pages, something like that, because that's when Molly Bloom really starts talking about her sexuality. So I wish that this musical concentrated on the fact of what is it like to be married or be with somebody, be the girlfriend, mistress, whatever you want to call it, of somebody who has written what is perceived at the time as pornography. I would think that would be a very difficult position to be in. I would think that many people would scorn you. Many people would chide you. Many people would have opinions on how you should be living your life. And none of that comes up. It really is the fact that James Joyce, once he becomes rich and famous, becomes truly insufferable. And that's why he's referred to as himself in the title. He does refer to himself at one point as the grand himself. You know, says a lot in the second act. I'm James Joyce, you know, with a sense of entitlement. Yes, God knows if any of us had a success like that, we would certainly have to deal with it. But we would like to think that we would get through it and be far more adorable about it than James Joyce is being, where suddenly he can't be told anything. And so I wasn't as interested in this domestic drama, which is essentially, you know, Adelaide doubled, you know, 14 years. Well, it was more than that with this lady, and she wants to get married. To me, that's trite, and to me, that's not as significant as what the story that should be told here. And because it must really be something, especially then, to be involved with somebody who's considered a pornographer. And also, did she think so? Did she think the book was wonderful? We didn't get much of that, I'll tell you. Did she think it was difficult? Could she get through it? I mean, Ulysses is a famously difficult novel, too. So I wish that Jonathan Brielle had worked with a collaborator who had said to him, no, here's the real story. Because I think it would have been a substantially more interesting one, and I would have really, really been into it. However, that said, I thought the music was quite pleasant and quite nice, and it had an Irish feel to it, certainly, but not to the point where it became cliched Irish. So I did like it. And Matt Bogart, a wonderful actor, really was quite, quite good as James Joyce. So my hat's off to him for doing a good job there. And I also thought Jessica Burroughs was wonderful as Nora. So they were quite good. Also, there's a writer I know named David Arthur, who I didn't know acted at all, and he showed up in a number of supporting roles, and he was terrific in each of them. So my hat's off to David Arthur, a marvelous writer, and now I know a marvelous actor.
Thanks, Peter. Are we finding the jewels in Nymph? How do you feel as the move from the fall to the summer worked out? Is this working out well for you?
It's okay for me, but as we said last week, I just wonder if a lot of people are out of town are movers and shakers because they're in the Hamptons, Montauk, wherever, and they're not seeing the shows, and the important people may not be around to have them moved to the next spot. So we'll see if they stay in the summer spot next year. It'll be very interesting to see if this move is successful. I wish them well, of course. I hope it does, you know, but we'll have to wait and see.
You know what I was thinking of? I was at a Nymph party the other night, and it occurred to me that that Ariel Tepper is not doing the Summer Play Festival anymore, SPF. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that would have been right around this time of year, and I I went to check it out, and their website is down, and everything is gone. So I guess maybe they've disassembled the Summer Play Festival, and Nymph is kind of taken into that spot. Michael got the new Evita cast recording, and we're going to talk about it for a few minutes. Michael, why don't you tell us what you think of it, the recording?
I really like it a lot. But I also, I'm someone who was and am a big fan of Elaina Rogers' performance in the show itself. I think she comes across even better on the CD for some reason. Even though you might think she would come over worse, because her acting is really one of the best things about her performance. But it turns out that her vocal acting in itself, you know, aside from her facial expressions and her movements and her emoting, it comes across very, very strongly on the CD. And damn if there isn't only that one place. I keep harping on it, but to me it's so amazing. There's one place in the song Buenos Aires where she's singing the first part, and then it gets to a part where she has to sing and if ever I go too far, and it's normally done by everyone who's done it in the past in either a raw belt voice or some kind of a mix that is a very strong sound, and that's really the only way that it can sound good. Now in the movie they had to bring the song down, they had to bring the key down considerably in order for Madonna to sing it and to sing that part that way. But here they kept the original key, and either because she can't or she chose not to, Elaina Rogers sings that and she sings it in a head voice, but it's a very low head voice that's right above her break, and it has a very, very odd, weak, unattractive sound to it. Almost as if, you know, someone trying to sound like someone who really, you know, imitates someone who can't sing well at all. And I hate to make too much of it, but every time I've seen the show or heard this CD, that strikes me. So I don't know why they didn't figure out a different solution to that point. They could have brought the song down a little bit, and that would have been enough to get her to sing it in a stronger belt-like voice. Or they could have, you know, maybe started the song in the original key and then modulated at some point during it. I think that was a really unfortunate decision. But other than that, I think she sounds great. Ricky Martin, I think, also comes across better on the CD because you can't see his very, very, very limited facial expressions and gestures. And as far as the actual vocal acting, again, it sounds pretty good, I would say. And everyone else sounds terrific. It's been reorchestrated in a very skillful way that you don't miss the fact that there aren't 15 violins as we hear in almost every other recording. So I thought it was a great success, and I'm glad.
I like
they
it too, Michael. Yeah. I do, and I think the sound of it is terrific. Yeah. It's the ideal sound for me on an original cast album when people are close up to the mic. So
yes.
I like that a great deal. I have to say very quickly that this week I got visited by one of my readers who lives in Argentina.
Wow.
So we met, and I said, "What are you seeing?" And Jersey Boys and what have you. And he gave a whole list. I said, "Are you seeing Evita?" Because I had heard that Evita could not be performed in Argentina. I really don't know if it's true, and he had such a thick accent, I really couldn't find the answer to the question. But he was 65 years old, and I said, "Well, wait a minute, by any chance, do you remember when she died?" And he went into a long, long talk about how vividly he remembered when she died, even though he was 5 or 6 years old, right, and what it was like in that country. He also talked about his uncle, who was a doctor, who didn't go to the funeral, and paid heavily for not going, that the Peronistas really certainly kept him from practicing after that. So it was quite harrowing to hear that. He did not think this was Santa Evita at all, as a result of the experiences he had with his family. So it. I also point out, I said, you know, when I went to Buenos Aires and came back, I immediately watched the movies, and isn't it something how they captured the sunlight of that city so perfectly? I mean, that really astonished me, that the sunlight I saw in Buenos Aires was exactly what was on the screen. And he said it was filmed in Budapest, actually. Well, who knew? Anyway, so that's that story.
Some of it was filmed in Argentina.
Certainly the Casa Rosada was. He conceded that. But yeah. He said, again, I'm not saying his word is law, but nevertheless, that's what he alleged.
All right, so I'll put a link in the show notes to Masterworks Broadway page on Evita, so you can check it out a little bit more and purchase it if you'd like. There's lots of different ways to purchase it on that page there. So just a few things that we should chat about for a minute before we run for the day, is Bernie Gersten is going to be stepping down at Lincoln Center at the end of June 30th, 2013, at the end of this theatrical season in June 30th, 2013, which I guess we've all known has been coming, and not for any, you know, malicious or bad reasons. He's been there for 28 years, and he probably wants to relax and do some other things.
But it's one of the building blocks that made it work.
Yeah. You know, so. I mean, he financially saved it and artistically... propelled it, and so it's going to be an end of a chapter, and it's interesting to see where it goes next. Who do you think we should nominate to take that over? I think maybe Nathan Lane. What do you think?
Well, they're saying they're not going to replace him. Andre Bishop will be the head, and then, you know, I mean, obviously he's got other people under him, but
yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean,
By the way, I was there. I was at Lincoln Center yesterday, and I'm going to see Slow Girl. I haven't seen it yet, but I said to my friend, you know, why don't we go up and take a look at the new theater, you know, to the extent that we can. But I maybe it was because it was right before showtime. We couldn't get past we couldn't even get into the cafe area, and we couldn't get in, and therefore we couldn't get onto the deck. So I don't know, because Peter, didn't you say it was your impression that you can go in even if you don't have a ticket?
I did get that impression, so I am surprised. I got the impression they really wanted to get customers for that cafe. So
yeah.
It ain't necessarily so, huh?
Yeah, I'll have to find out more about that because I'm a little confused. But anyway, it certainly looks like a beautiful setup. There's this kind of, there's a balcony, like an outdoor area that really looks like a deck, you know. Like the wooden deck, and the cafe looks great, and so I'm really looking forward to see the inside of the theater.
All right. Also happening this week in the news is that Feinstein's is going to be closing in December, and December 31st. But there's a rumor that they're going to open up at a new spot. Michael, we have any updates about this?
No, but it's so interesting because the first report I read. I think the headline, and I don't remember where it was, but it said Feinstein's will be moving.
Yeah.
And you know, what you read is what is in your mind. So I said, okay, you know, and then I was reading the quotes from Michael Feinstein about where, you know, that they don't know where they're going, but they're going somewhere else. But then some of the other reports just said it's closing and didn't emphasize that there might or would be a move. So really, who knows if it's how solid the plans are for it to move anywhere. And all the more reason, you know, I was just saying recently how it's great that 54 Below has opened. And I said that before I knew that Feinstein's was closing. I was just comparing it to mentioning it in the context of the Oak Room at the Algonquin closing, there are very few, very, very few, and now even one less high-end cabaret rooms left in the city.
To be fair, we should mention that Feinstein's is closing because the hotel is enduring a renovation. It's not as if they're going out of business because they weren't doing business. Well, they may or may not have been doing business, but nevertheless, the real reason here is the hotel is going to be taking over and sprucing up. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. All right. So before we go, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you, so you won't miss anything in the interim. There's also the Broadway Radio survey. If you would be so kind as to go to BroadwayRadio.com and take the survey, it'll help us understand who's listening to the podcast. And also, if you do subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, please leave us some comments and feedback. Rate our podcast on iTunes because it really helps Apple promote us. If folks go there and rate us, they will promote us and we'll get more listeners and we'll have more fun. It's all about the fun, isn't it? Mm-hmm. At BroadwayRadio.com, you'll see the contact info for Peter, Michael, and me there. As well as different ways to listen to us through Stitcher on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7, and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And our Facebook, Twitter, email addresses, various things like that is there as well. So what's coming up this week for you guys? More Nymph or other stuff?
Yeah, more Nymph indeed. I'm seeing a few, so that really takes a good deal of time, yeah.
Michael?
Yeah, I'm going to be seeing Slow Girl this week, and Alec Mappa has a show called Baby Daddy, which I'm really looking forward to, because I've seen him do stand-up and do a lot of it. He does a lot of material on little children, and he does it so well, I have to say. So that's something that I'm really looking forward to.
All right. Next week, we're going to be speaking with David Lefkowitz, who's going to come in and talk with us. So we're looking forward to that. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, all.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise, don't keep your distance. And as for fortune and as for fame, I never invited them in, though it seemed to the world they were all I desired. The solutions they promised to be. The answer was here all the time. I love you and hope you love me. Don't cry for me, Argentina. Said too much. There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word is listen to that, the voice of Argentina. We are adored, we are loved.
Statesmanship is more than entertaining peasants.
We shall see, little man.
When someone pretty lower class can be respected and admired.